This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is the New Books Network podcast. My name is Joseph Edwards, and today I'm excited to bring you an interview with the music writer, historian, and broadcaster, Dr. Leah Broad. Her book, Quartet, How Four Women Challenged the Musical World, was first published by Faber in 2023, and a recent paperback edition prompts our discussion today. Leah is a historical musicologist working as a faculty member and a junior research fellow at Christ Church, Oxford. She writes that, "All my work focuses on unfamiliar histories. I'm fascinated by the people and music who are at the margins of histories about Western art music." Her career extends into work as a broadcaster and journalist. She is the winner of the 2015 Observer/Anthony Burgess Prize for Arts Journalism, and has written for outlets including The Guardian, Observer, LRB and BBC Music Magazine, as well as for numerous academic journals. In 2016, Leah was selected as a BBC New Generation Thinker and has since appeared on BBC Radio and TV covering classical music. The writer Kate Moss described Quartet as a wonderful, gripping, page-turning read. I couldn't agree more. Leah, I literally devoured this book, so it's really such a pleasure to speak with you today.
Thank you so much for inviting me on. I'm really glad you enjoyed the book.
Oh, I did. It's rare to have a biography that's such a page-turner. I mean, I think Kate Moss really summed it up.
Right. Yeah, in one of my favourite reviews, it got referred to, I think, as something like a Victorian bodice ripper. I was like, yes, please. That is exactly the book I've written, I hope.
Perfect. So Quartet interweaves the life of four composers. We have Ethel Smyth, who's the first woman to receive a damehood for composition and is in many ways, I suppose, the overarching figure and potentially the most recognised name of the four. She propels the narrative, and the strength of her personality I found an immediately captivating force, and it must be a gift for any biographer. But through Ethel, we encounter three other composers. We have Rebecca Clark, Dorothy Howell and Doreen Carwithin. I was just wondering if you'd be able to do a brief introduction of each of these women.
As you say, Ethel Smyth is the overarching personality of Quartet. And the reason why she's so central is because she was so important to classical music history. And I think it's very odd that so many histories of British music history have been written without Ethel Smyth in, or if she is, she's kind of a funny footnote. So what I'm trying to do is put her kind of back at the center of the narrative where she belongs, because she's a really fascinating composer. So she's born in 1858 and she writes six operas, all of which were staged in her lifetime. She's also politically active. She was a militant suffragette. She was friends, probably lovers, with Emmeline Pankhurst. She's jailed alongside Emmeline Pankhurst for her involvement with the Women's Social and Political Union. She writes the anthem for the women's suffrage movement. And she's just an incredible force of nature. Her music is bold, it is powerful, and she was so significant in terms of the way that women and women's composition was perceived in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Then after that comes Rebecca Clarke. So she's a generation younger than Ethel Smyth and a completely different personality, different kind of composer. Ethel Smyth just says what's on her mind, whereas Rebecca Clarke was very reserved, very careful about curating her public image. She's a consummate professional, and she has a dual career as both a composer and as a viola player. She's a pioneering viola player, and that really shows in her compositions. She writes some of, I think, still to this day, some of the best works in the repertoire for the viola. Dorothy Howell is the third composer. She's probably the least known of all the composers in the book, partly because so little of her music, and especially her large orchestral music, was ever published. So it's only, I'm delighted to say, this month, there's been a premiere recording of some of her large orchestral works, which is great because we can start to get a sense of who this woman was a little better. But the reason that she's in the book is because in her own lifetime, she was kind of named alongside Smyth and Clarke as the sort of the three leading women composers in Britain at the time. She's an orchestral composer. She came to fame in 1919 with this piece called Lamia that was done at the proms and was so successful, it had to be repeated multiple times in the season. And then lastly, we have Doreen Carwithan. And the reason I chose her is because, I mean, my goodness, 20th century composers in Britain, there are so many women who I could have picked. But I went with Carwithan because she was a film composer. And that's still something that's seen as a little bit unusual for women to do today. That's changing, thank goodness. But certainly even 5 years ago, five, 6 years ago now, when I started writing the book, a tiny percentage of Hollywood scores were written by women. And so I wanted to show, actually, there was this precedent in the 40s and 50s. Here is a woman who had a phenomenally successful career as a film composer. She also was a completely different personality, has a very different life story to the other three. And her music, again, it sounds very different. So I thought they made a nice four as a kind of group.
That's perfect introduction to all four of them. And I guess, like, doing a bit of research on your background, this wasn't initially your academic focus. It seemed that you had research interest in incidental music in Nordic countries, so and theatrical music, if I'm right. And so I was just wondering, firstly, what prompted this switch from, you know, from Sibelius to Smyth, and when each of these composers started to appear in your life?
Yeah, so for a bit of background, as you say, I actually wrote my PhD on Nordic theatre music, and Sibelius was central in that. And what kind of ties the two together is this focus on archival work, on researching music that's very little written about. Because even though a composer like Sibelius is hugely famous, what is really very little known about is his theatrical music and the fact he wrote a large number of incidental scores. And I found it so exciting being able to kind of look at these famous figures and say, well, actually, what are the stories behind them that we aren't so familiar with? And so I was doing a lot of sort of research alongside my PhD about lesser known British works. And that was how I came to Dorothy Howell. But also, I grew up as a pianist. I was originally training to be a concert pianist. That was what I loved. That's what I wanted to do. And I don't think it really occurred to me until I went to university as an undergraduate that I never played music by women. And there was this point where there was a course on women composers at my university. And I sat there and I thought, I've never played any music by women. And there was this, you know, I didn't do my undergraduate so long ago now, but I think the way we think about music by women has changed quite drastically, actually, in those years. And there was a sort of overhanging idea that there was the great music, the really good stuff, which was the core of the university course. And then there was the music by women, which was an optional extra that was studied because, well, you know, women, we sort of had to do it because it's political. And that was a very common way to think about music that was written by women. And I love good music. And so I was like, I'm not sure I want to spend a lot of time studying music that happened to be written by women. And then the thing that started changing that story for me was I was listening to a podcast and I hadn't looked at what it was. I just heard this piece of music that utterly blew me away. And I went to find out who it was, and it was Rebecca Clark's Viola Sonata. And I went, hang on a minute. this doesn't fit. This piece of music is exquisite. This is extraordinary. I heard it and I immediately wanted to play it. And the more music I found by her, the more I kind of thought, oh my God, this woman, she could compose. Like, she was unbelievably good. And it just didn't fit this story that music by women was worth studying because it was by women rather than because the music was utterly brilliant. And that, you know, I came to all the women in quartet first through their music. And the reason I wanted to write about them is because ultimately their music is unbelievably exciting. It is gripping. It is music that I wanted to play and music that I do play. And so I was doing all of this sort of research in the background, and I came to think about what I wanted to do after my PhD. And by that point, I was like, actually, this is a full research project. This is what I want to be writing next. And that was sort of how it came about. So this came out of my sort of postdoctoral research. And it is this sort of fascination with, why haven't these stories been told? The music is there, the composers are there. Why aren't they in the history books that I studied at university?
Absolutely. And even when you catch sort of instances of Ethel Smyth's name or things like that when you're studying musicology, it's always an instance, and you never quite get a sense of their full character. And I often found that when I encountered people like Ethel Smyth, it was rarely for their musical output. It was for the kind of broader characterization. And I feel like her, specifically Ethel Smyth, comes with a lot of baggage within the music world. But I think potentially my next approach, my next question would be then to ask you about your approach to researching the book, because you write of how Dorothy was not someone who tried to shape her legacy or image, and that contrasts so much with a composer like Ethel Smyth, who penned 11 books and hundreds of articles, and you also write that she went back to edit her diaries. So I was wondering how each of these characters and the material that you had to work with sort of differed, and how the actual material that you had at your disposal said something about each of their characters.
The material I had told me so much about who these people were, and particularly at the time of their deaths, where they thought they were going to be in the position in music history. So, for example, all of Ethel Smyth's letters and diaries are in archives, but they're spread out all over the place. It's a bit chaotic. There's no published volume, for example, of her diaries, of her letters, of her correspondence. There are nearly 2,000 letters between her and Harry Brewster, and they've just not been published, right? They are practically unknown. And they're so important to understanding both her love life and also her creative partnership with him. I mean, my goodness, he wrote the libretto for her third opera. And because they were living in different countries at the time, we've got that entire opera on paper, how it came about. And that's so unusual and really fascinating to see how that collaboration sort of developed and these two creative minds at work. But so she was clearly in her diaries thinking for posterity. You know, she was at the time of her death. She was the first woman to be made a dame for composition in Britain. She had 3 honorary doctorates. She was an incredibly important figure. But something that broke my heart, honestly, writing this book was reading her diaries, and she said, oh, you know, I'm scared that when I die, my music will die with me because there'll be nobody left to fight for it. And at the same time, she's going back and sort of scratching bits out of the diary, obviously thinking with a mind to publication that, you know, she wanted tweaked a little bit just in case. And I thought, come on, she's so incredibly famous. You're here editing your diaries on the off chance that somebody publishes them. Of course, your music's not going to die as quickly as you think it is. And then I read her obituaries, and she's not been dead very long. And the obituaries say things like, oh, you know, she'll be remembered as a good writer and somebody who made a stir by writing music that was unusual for a woman. Wow. And that's her obituaries. And it happens immediately. There's this immediate drop off in the amount that her music is played after her death. And she was right. With somebody like Dorothy Howell, the situation is completely different. When she died in the 1980s, she was almost completely unknown, to the extent that she became really depressed about how little her music was being performed, and she tried to burn the entire lot. And it's only thanks to the very quick thinking of her niece and nephew that her manuscripts survive at all, and they remain in a family home with her niece and nephew. So, you know, there are bits in cardboard boxes, in apple boxes, in like Cadbury's chocolate boxes. It's chaotic. It's never been catalogued, and it's alongside all her letters, all her recipe books are in there. She was Catholic, and so she had sort of her prayer books as well. They're all just together, heaped together. And that presented such an exciting challenge for writing this group biography, where with somebody like Ethel Smyth, I was wading through hundreds of articles about her and creating this mythology around her that I had to try and acknowledge, but also cut through, because I think a lot has been written about Ethel Smyth that needs to be challenged. Whereas with Dorothy Howell, I didn't have that kind of mythology around her. And it was quite difficult, but also refreshing to be able to tell this woman's story fresh from scratch almost, because there weren't books about her, there weren't all these articles shaping the way that she can be understood. And so I felt like I could bring her to a 21st century audience without having to counteract all the 20th century narratives about her. But of course, what I was having to counteract was the fact that her music wasn't published and hadn't been recorded. So what I could do with Rebecca Clark in particular was say to my readers, go listen to this incredible piece of music. You don't have to believe me. You don't have to take my word for it. You can go listen and make up your mind for yourself. Whereas with Dorothy Howell, I didn't have that ability so much. So it was a challenge to kind of present this composer. And the reason that I'm writing about them is not audible for the majority of her works. You know, there were a few recordings, and I've tried to sort of push people towards those in the discography at the end of the book, but it's just such a different.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I found it very hard to find stuff to listen to when I was reading your book. But I guess I would like to pick you up on the you talk about mythologies, and I think that's such an interesting aspect of writing a biography, because you clearly thought so carefully about the potential ethics and the discourse that frequently surrounds, I guess, a kind of dredging up of names from history. And I think in making this a group biography, stop the tendency to isolate women as historical anomalies or singular figures. You write that historical forgetting is such a powerful form of erasure. It robs women of role models and leaves them going in circles. And, you know, this is no hagiography. You're not attempting to rewrite or mythologize history. So I would love to hear your thoughts about the kind of potential ethics surrounding a curation of another person's public image and how that differed so wildly from these figures.
That is such a good question. And oh my goodness, I thought so hard about this, because it feels like there's a lot of responsibility telling these women's stories. And I was really lucky with Clark, Howell and Carwithen to work really closely with their families and with people who knew them. And so it was such a privilege to they were so generous with their time in terms of sharing what, like, stories and their impressions of their relatives. But also they gave me the space when I said, actually, I'm going to write something you're going to disagree with. And they said, okay, you know what? So I was so lucky to be able to work with those people and to have their support. And it was really important to me that even when I said stuff they disagreed with, that they would recognize the person who emerged at the end of the book. So that was something that I thought about very hard when writing. And also, you know, I think there is this tendency, particularly because women have been left on the margins of music history, there is this tendency to write about women as if they could do no wrong. They're perfect. They're wonderful. Everything they did, the sun comes out of everywhere. And I really disagree with that. I think if women are going to be taken seriously as historical figures, they need to be, there needs to be space for them to have been a bit dubious, to have had some bad moments, and to be sometimes very difficult to write about. And so there are some moments in the book where I've really tried to bring out the fact that these women weren't saints. They did things that they were selfish sometimes. They held views that are incompatible with 21st century perspectives as well. In some ways, we'd see them as very progressive for their time. In other ways, they were very regressive. But I think without that, we can't really understand who they were or indeed what their impact was and why they did the things that they did. So I've tried very hard to show a full perspective on these people as well.
Comes across totally. I mean, you begin with a concert from 1930, which honored the suffragette Emmeline Pankhurst, and Ethel is conducting, and she's conducting the Metropolitan Police Band, which just had such a wonderful irony to me, given the activism of her and Emmeline and the time they both spent in the now closed Holloway prison. But I also felt that this dichotomy characterized the contradictions within Ethel's character specifically. She was a figure who stood out, she stood for, she was bold, eccentric, you know, a provocative and central figure in any room. She forced people to think. And at the same time, she was also socially conservative. She was a child of empire. And you mention how this social conservatism was also intrinsic to the suffragette movement. You call it a civilizing force that was rooted in Victorian racial ideology, an imperial feminism that cast white, middle-class British, and especially English women as the potential saviors of their counterparts in colonial countries. Ethel composed the opera Boson while staying in Egypt. She frequently espoused racist sentiments in her letters to Emmeline from Egypt, which neither of them seemed to disagree with. And it what shows is that she was a flawed, complex, and a very real human being. And without acknowledging this, you say that we end up with a very strange whitewashed view of history, with our predecessors painted as heroes seen through 21st century eyes, history as we want it, not how it was. Could you tell us a little bit more about those contradictions specifically within Ethel's character as a sort of both social provocateur and establishment figure?
Yeah. And with Ethel Smyth, it's really acute because she's so progressive in some ways in terms of fighting for women's rights in Britain. In other ways, you know, her father was a military man. She comes from a military family. She's very pro-army. She's very conservative in a lot of her social views. And one of the ways that this comes out is in her views about race. And I think it's very important that there are these letters between two ostensibly feminist leaders in the early 20th century, between Ethel Smyth and Emmeline Pankhurst. And I think it's quite important to understand the way that their views about, I think it's quite important to be able to understand their views about race because it shaped the feminist movement. These people weren't inconsequential. And if we want to understand the way that feminism and feminist movements have sort of played out in Britain over the 20th century, we have to be able to come to terms with the ways in which women of colour have sometimes been pushed to the margins by white women. And a lot of that has to do with imperial legacies as well. And so that was why I really didn't want to sort of pretend that didn't happen between Ethel Smyth and Emmeline Pankhurst, or to try and present it in a light other than that which it is. These views were very commonplace in the early 20th century. Does that excuse them? No, it means that we should be able to analyze them, I think, and say, okay, what are the implications of that?
In addition to Ethel, Dorothy and Doreen were obviously predominantly conservative figures, and it was actually Rebecca who was far more left-wing and liberal in her political stance. I found your book fascinating in the way that it combined these four really different political figures, and with it, it allowed a rich understanding of many decades of 20th century politics. I was just wondering what you pinpoint as the root of this social conservatism, though, even as artists, like women artists, were looking for representation in post-war Britain.
I think all of the women in the book were really conscious of the fact that they were women, and that if they were too progressive or they stood out too much, they risked additional censure beyond the fact of their gender. And I think Rebecca Clark was not afraid to say, okay, well, this is what I stand for. These are the people who I will associate with. But I think that there is definitely for all of them a sense of, well, we're already, just by stepping into a room, seen as unusual or odd or different. And so then there's a tendency to react against that and say, yes, I'm unusual and odd and different because I'm a woman, but not in any other way. I'm really very safe in all the ways other than the fact that I'm a woman. Also, you know, all of them came from very middle-class backgrounds. I think that's not, you know, it's not a surprise in some sense. It was quite expensive to learn a classical instrument. And so, unsurprisingly, women who have the sort of financial backing to be able to go and study at the places like the Royal Academy and Royal College, move into professional musical circles, which shapes their political stances as well. And Dorothy Howell, additionally, was Catholic, and her faith was really important to her. And I think that sort of grounded her in a quite conservative worldview sometimes that she didn't sort of push beyond. So I think there are a number of reasons that those three women in particular were sort of had the political background that they did. And Rebecca Clark, I think, is just a completely different person. Also, she had a career that moved between the US and the UK. And so that shapes her political thinking as well in a way that is less prominent with the others, because Ethel Smyth's main point of contact was with Germany and with France, and Dorothy Howell and Doreen Culwithan don't travel as much at all. So they're really very rooted in a very British way of thinking.
Literally. So over the course of the 19th and 20th century, you chart a large period of history. You can kind of see a gradual shift in public understanding of women as composers. So your book argues, I think, that this was a shift that allowed women their interiority. So where music had often been a communal activity, where the performance was a femininity, sort of intrinsically linked to social worth, class status, and also frequently to finding a husband, composition instead required a real acknowledgement of depth and interiority, deep, serious thought, and that was largely absent from public life and discourse around women. You said it was thought not just unlikely, but a biological impossibility for women to manage the kind of abstract thought associated with composition. And we see Ethel was even diagnosed in Leipzig as having nerves caused by cerebral excitement, which was caused by composing too much.
Who hasn't had a case of the nerves caused by cerebral excitement?
Absolutely. I guess we see that composing was unsuitable, unseemly, and also potentially unhealthy. And I was wondering if you could expand on how these, I guess, psychosocial influences and notions of interiority played a part in the careers of these composers, either in subverting and breaking through them or in the ways they might have been internalized.
Yeah, so this is the idea that women are literally biologically incapable of classical composition, particularly large-scale composition, because it requires as a combination of emotional and rational thought. And while emotional thought is possible for women, the rational part is simply beyond them. And that's backed up with Victorian science in heavy, heavy quotes. And that's the prevailing view when Ethel Smyth is coming up as a composer. And indeed, it lingers right on into the 20th century. And I think that does impact certainly on the way that others viewed them. It was thought more acceptable for women to write songs because they could perform them, and that was very attractive. And also because song forms tended to be smaller and follow a text, that was thought to be more plausible for women to handle than something like a symphony or an opera. And this is why I find Ethel Smyth so fascinating, because in this world, she says, no, I'm going to write an opera. I'm going to write six operas. And something that gets written about a lot with regard to Ethel Smyth's music, both by her supporters and her detractors, is that her music was very masculine. That's something that's used a lot. It's virile, it's masculine, it's powerful. And that was seen as surprising, even though it shouldn't be. And I think Ethel Smyth makes the most of that. So she really leans into this being an unusual woman. But that's partly why I didn't want to write just about Ethel Smyth, because she really was very unusual for her time. And I think not many women would have wanted to lead the life that Ethel Smyth did. And I think later with Dorothy Howell, for example, this idea that large-scale composition is beyond women really plays into the excitement around her work in 1919, because she's 21 when this piece Lamia is premiered. And the way that the press write about her is so infantilizing. It's extraordinary. They sort of go, oh my goodness, child genius, child prodigy, is performed at the proms. You're like, she's a woman of 21. Come on. And they're talking about her going to the zoo with her little brother in this very sort of quaint way, but painting her basically as an infant. And unfortunately, that continues sort of throughout the coming years, and it reflects a lot in her reception, is then they start to say, oh, she has a merely imitative feminine gift when it comes to composition, and sort of playing right back into these stereotypes of women being sort of incapable of original thought and are only capable of copying things or interpreting things. And in terms of the ways it was internalized, I think all of the women I've written about managed to push against that model to the point where they did actually have professional careers as composers. So I think these women internalized it far less than a lot of others who were writing at the same time. Having said that, Ethel Smyth, particularly when she's younger, did have this sense, I think, of, oh gosh, should I actually be taking time off practice because I've got the nerves? And, you know, she takes her diagnosis seriously. And I think but because she's a very unusual woman, she'll take time off for a few weeks and then go, actually, I'm fine. This is ridiculous. Obviously, I'm going back to work. But there is that sense of her having to grapple with particularly these medical diagnoses that are sort of pushed onto her, that I think a lot of other women might have paid more attention to and therefore kept out of a professional sphere in a way that Ethel Smyth is just not prepared to do.
Mm-hmm. No, completely. I mean, reviewers and the role of the press is also at the heart of this biography. And it was interesting to read how each of them would react against them. So while you had Ethel firing off letters to the Times right, left and centre, the others seemed to use a kind of slightly caustic humour in order to tackle their reviews. So for one example, in 1977, when Rebecca listened to her viola sonata's first public performance in decades, she responded to the New York Times review, which was sort of surprising in its positivity, by saying, I take this opportunity to emphasize that I do indeed exist, which really made me laugh. And Dorothy also collected funny reviews, like that had crazy critical jargon that was used by the press at that time, that had wild levels of pretentiousness. And a particular favorite that she jotted down on a scrap of paper was the tightly controlled application of the aleatoric principle of indeterminacy is both simpler and intellectually more honest than Stockhausen's logarithmic methods for creating sprays of sound. So it's like an utterly ridiculous statement. But obviously what these women were up against, and the press had such a more influential role in the classical music industry at that point than it possibly does now. And I was wondering if you could just reflect on the role of the press and how it influenced their lives and also change possibly as they went through the decade.
I mean, the musical press at this point, they are tastemakers. They decide, they have a huge amount of power over what is performed, how it's received, how it's thought about, whether future performances are secured after initial premiere. You know, if you put a piece out into the world and it gets absolutely panned, people won't pick it up again. If it goes out into the world and the critics adore it, obviously it's far more likely to get repeat performances. And repeat performances are vital for composers, because if your work is unfamiliar, how can it be somebody's favorite work? It's just not possible. And I think that there is a certain extent to which, obviously, the role of the kind of the centralized journalist writing at a newspaper about music, that power's been sort of spread out a little bit by blogging, by the sort of the availability of online reviewing. Having said that, there's still a huge amount of cultural cachet that comes with reviews. And I think it's important to recognize that the narratives that we use about music, the language that we use about music by women, is really important. It shapes the way that readers hear this music. It shapes the way people come to music written by women. And I guess if I have a plea to reviewers, it's to be really conscious of the language that you're using when you're reviewing works by women. Because still, very often I'll read a review or an interview with a woman, and they'll be asked questions that, you know, a man would not have been asked. There's a lot of questions about childcare, about how you juggle this with being a mom, and where are all those questions to the men, please? That would be nice, because it is something that I think actually, you know, a lot of my friends who are men who are having kids, they are having to think about these questions as well. So if you care about it for a woman, you should also care about it for a man. Or just don't ask the question, right? If you're only going to apply it to just women, don't do that. Why? And I think these sort of stereotyping and tendencies to fall into particular tropes about the way women dress on stage as well, that's another thing that gets talked about a lot, often in terms that are very obviously gendered and sometimes sexualized as well. I think we really do, as writers about music, have a responsibility to think about the terms that we use, the language that we use, and how we use that language, because language is powerful.
Absolutely. And I think the language that was used at the time, you incorporate it into the biography in a really clever way. You really get a sense of the landscape, the linguistics, the way these things are framed. And I also really enjoyed how you use that to talk about these composers' relationships. So rather than importing our contemporary discourse on the relationships of these women were having, you actually use their own description. So with Ethel Smythe, you used her own terminology. You talked about her passions, allowing her to still speak for herself on the subject of her sexuality. But you know, romantic lives are often characterized as extra-diegetic, or they pose the danger of sensationalizing the professional lives of individuals, especially when you're dealing with the professional lives of women. And your depictions of the romantic lives of these four women is really approached with a great sensitivity, and you acknowledge how important it is to understand their relationships with lovers, with friends and family, and how critical these are as a window into understanding the life of any composer. And I was wondering if you could talk me through the process of writing about their varied romantic lives. And I imagine that was a very sensitive part of the process.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad it comes across as sensitively handled, because goodness, it was really hard, particularly bearing in mind that there is this tendency to write about women's private lives rather than their professional lives and sensationalize. And I really didn't want to do that. Having said that, I think part of Ethel Smyth in particular, her progressiveness, her power, her musical creativity as well, stemmed from her private life. And so I had to write about it. And so Ethel Smyth, she never labeled her sexuality. And I think that was so important for me in terms of writing the book, is that the social context in which she was having relationships is so different to the 21st century that I didn't want to start importing contemporary labels and putting them on her. Having said that, there was a lot that was recognizable about the patterns of her relationships. And so I didn't want to create too much distance either. So she had far more relationships with women than with men. Having said that, one of her sort of central creative partnerships was with a man called Henry Brewster, and she had a sexual relationship with him as well. And she had other relationships with women while she was with Henry Brewster. So it's this kind of thing where, were she living today, who knows how she might have identified herself. She could have been polyamorous or pansexual or queer or bisexual. Who knows what label she would have chosen? Maybe she wouldn't have chosen to label herself at all. She certainly didn't in her own lifetime. And so that's why I really wanted to use her own terminology when she writes about, she does call these people her passions. She doesn't call them her lovers. She doesn't call them all these other things or her partner. She calls them her passions. And I think that captured something really beautiful about the role that these people play in her life. They are these all-consuming sort of affairs of the heart that shape her world. While she's with this person or multiple people, they are everything to her. And she's one of these people where, with some composers, it can be really hard to draw a connection between their lives and works. And Ethel Smyth is not like that. There are sometimes very direct and explicit links with her life influencing her creativity. And so I really wanted to be able to show, actually, these relationships aren't extraneous to her professional life. They're intrinsic to it. And we have to understand them if we want to understand her music, the way it's written, how she thinks about composition as a process, what it's for, why she writes. And there are lots of instances of her works being dedicated to or written for her passions. One of which, for example, is this beautiful song, Possession, which was dedicated to Emmeline Pankhurst. And it's written at a time when Emmeline Pankhurst was coming in and out of jail as part of the Cat and Mouse Act in the UK. So she'd go into jail, hunger strike, be released. She would convalesce at Ethel Smyth's house and then go back into prison again and start starving herself again. And Ethel Smyth had to watch the woman she loved wasting away. And there's a point where she says, "I'm sorry, I can't do this anymore. And I can't ask you to stop fighting for women's rights. I wouldn't want to do that because I know it drives you. And I wouldn't want to ever ask you to not be yourself, but I can't watch you die. I just can't do it. It's too painful. I need to leave." And so that's the point where she goes to Egypt. And this song, Possession, I mean, it's not a subtle connection, but it's a song about loving somebody so much you have to let them go. But it's so beautiful and intimate and poignant. And I think knowing the context behind it completely changed for me the way I heard that song and what it meant to its composer as well. And it very much felt like a kind of private declaration of a really selfish woman trying to be selfish, selfless, sorry, in some senses. Like, Ethel Smyth was so self-absorbed. She had to be to get where she was. And this is the point where she says, "I have to put you first, even though it utterly kills me to do so. Here's me making sense of that. And me saying to you, I still love you more than anything else." And that to me was just so moving to understand that context behind it.
Yeah, I mean, she was always a friend to people. And she had a gift for friendship, as Edith Somerville said, which I thought was, it really summed it up beautifully. I think I'd just like to touch on one other thing in relation to this, which was a kind of undercurrent throughout the novel of breaches of trust, of either abuse in the form of physical assaults that Joseph, Rebecca's father, inflicted on his wife Agnes and daughter Rebecca with, but also an abuse of trust. And that felt like a strong presence within this biography. For example, how Doreen, Rebecca and Ethel were all the subject of romantic interests from their tutors. So you had Percy Miles, the family friend and tutor to Rebecca, who ended up proposing to her. There's also a suggestion that Ethel's first harmony tutor, Alexander Ewing, held romantic interests in her. And then we also have the most complex case of the book, which is with Doreen Carwithin and William Alwyn, who was her harmony teacher, who she met in her early 20s when William was 36. And it sparked one of the most fraught and, I don't know, quite frankly, insane relationships I've ever heard of. He had a wife called Olive Poole at the time they met, and they conducted a 20-year affair with each other before William finally left Olive. This hampered Doreen's career. Whilst William was becoming one of Britain's leading film composers, he kind of stops her from going abroad to study. And when they eventually move in together, Doreen changes her name to Mary Alwyn, and completely dedicates herself to him, even writing her diary as William. So there are these like repeated instances of that pupil-student dynamic, really resulting in either a sort of complicated relationship or just a fundamental breach of trust that really undermines these women. And I was wondering what your impressions were of some of these relationships, how they may have affected the personal and professional lives of these women, especially in the earliest stages of their life and study and compositional development.
Yeah, and this felt like such an important thing to be writing about, particularly in light of the current things to do with sexual misconduct in music conservatoires. And actually, this is not a new phenomenon. This is literally centuries old. And what really struck me with Rebecca Clark, so this is, she applies for the Royal Academy on the advice of this man, Percy Miles, who is a family friend. She trusts him. He becomes her harmony tutor. And then sort of out of the blue, he proposes to her. And this makes her life incredibly difficult. And she writes in her memoir this really striking passage where she talks about him kissing her, and she just does not know what to do. She's uncomfortable. It's unpleasant. She's worried about offending him. She's worried about the fact that she's not sexually attracted to him. She doesn't know what to do. She's a teenager. And I think this is something that's quite revealing, is that she knew it was wrong. She was uncomfortable. It's not that it was like, oh, this is the norm of the time. She was very uncomfortable, and I think would have been aware of the potential impacts on not just her personal life, but on her professional life. You know, she doesn't eventually marry until she's in her 50s, after she's had her career and she's at the point where she's thinking of retiring. And I think because she's very acutely aware of the fact that marriage means, for women, having children and putting your career to one side, and she does not want to do that. Having said that, when she reports this incident to her mother and she says, well, actually, this guy kissed me and he's proposed to me, her mother's almost like, well, great. You know, there are worse matches to be made. Off you go. her father says, absolutely not. This is a disgrace, and removes her from the academy. So there are these really complex dynamics happening here. But it happens a lot. And Rebecca Clark, over the course of her life, I mean, my goodness, this woman had to turn down a proposal a week, practically. And sometimes, usually, it was from men who were her professional colleagues. They were in positions of power. And it made her professional life like jumping through a sort of obstacle course all the time, because she had to sort of find a way to politely reject these men in a way that they would not find so offensive that they would basically try and destroy her career. that is an incredibly hard thing to do, and something that she has to deal with all the time because she happened to be quite pretty and because she was outspoken and she was an attractive woman. But unfortunately,
and specifically an attractive woman on stage, which is
exactly. Yeah. And I think this meant that there were a lot of people who sort of loved this idea of her and this image of her and wanted to almost control that. And she says no. But that is just something that she has to deal with as a professional that men wouldn't have had to deal with, at least to the same extent of being always sexualized, always seen by their gender first and then as a professional second. And also this idea that sort of, well, yes, you're on stage as a professional now, but only because you're not married yet. And as soon as you get married, you know, this is a temporary thing. With Doreen Kerwithin, oh my God, this is such a complicated situation because she meets William Alwyn when he's her harmony tutor. She's at the Royal Academy. She's, I think, quite a naive person. She's grown up in a relatively sheltered background. She comes to the Royal Academy with not much life experience behind her, but she is a woman, you know, in her sort of late teens, early 20s. She does have agency. She chooses to enter into this relationship with William Alwyn, but he's in a position of power over her. Obviously, there are questions about power and agency here, which particularly as a sort of feminist historian, I think about quite critically, to put it mildly. But she stays in this relationship with him and keeps it secret from everybody for 20 years, and it shapes her career, it shapes her life, it shapes her personality. And this really, I think, came home to me when I was interviewing people who knew her at the end of her life, when she had become Mary Alwyn, the famous composer's wife, and nobody knew she composed at all. And they described her as this very quiet, very retiring woman who was not particularly interesting. And that was just so different to the woman who I saw described in the 1940s when she was, you know, a 20-year-old, up and coming. She was writing this bold, vibrant music. She was asking for equal pay in the film studios at a time when equal pay was not, you know, on the table really for women. She was incredibly determined. She knew her own mind. She was just such a different personality. And I think a large part of that sort of retreating into herself and pushing herself to the margins is to do with the fact that she got used to erasing herself and erasing what she wanted to prioritize this relationship with William. And, you know, Olive, William Alwyn's first wife, also put aside her career for him. Yeah. So I think at that point you have to start sort of looking at patterns of behavior and the fact that actually there are two women with extraordinary careers who sort of got pushed to one side to prioritize this man.
Yeah. And you mentioned that in her final days, she told a friend that she was not Mary Alwyn, she was Doreen Kerwithin. And that was, yeah, quite a striking moment. But Rebecca actually found real harmony and, I don't know, just a beautiful relationship at the end of her life.
I am so glad James is like such the good news story in quartet. And I think I fell a little bit in love with James Friskin's set and her reading their letters. He's so nice and he encourages her. And he's just a delightful person. So thank goodness at least one woman ended up in a happy and fulfilling and fruitful partnership. Hooray for James Friskin.
Hooray for James Friskin, yeah. I think we're coming to the end of this little interview, but I feel like we haven't fully actually talked about the music that much. And I was just wondering, as a little parting gift, whether you could just recommend, you know, a composition or two from each of these composers for us to go away and listen to.
Absolutely. So I've already mentioned a few pieces, so I'm going to not mention them again. With Ethel Smyth, I would recommend her last kind of really big work, which is the symphonic cantata called The Prison. There's a wonderful recording that got made as I was writing the book, actually, and it won a Grammy. It's a really good recording, so I strongly recommend that. And that's written to a text by Harry Brewster, and I think it's sort of her requiem for him. It's her finally, nearly 30 years after he died, saying goodbye to him. For Rebecca Clark, I'm going to recommend her song, The Seal Man. This is a dark and vicious song. I love it. It's really brutal. I enjoy that a lot. I think also her viola sonata is great. So I'll just mention that again. I go against my rule. Dorothy Howell, if you can get hold of the recording of her violin sonata, I think this is a glorious piece of music. But other than that, I'm going to recommend the recording of her orchestral music that's just come out with Rebecca Miller conducting. That's great. It gives a really good idea of who this woman was and her compositional voice. For Doreen Carwithen, the piano concerto, oh my goodness, this is the piece that really got me into Doreen Carwithen's music. And it shows why she was such a good film composer. It's really exciting. It's narrative. Yeah, I think it's a great piece of music.
Oh, fab. No, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you.
Have a lovely day.
You too.